You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. This episode was first broadcast on the 10th of January 2012. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Hugo MacDonald. The short days and long dark nights of January in the Northern Hemisphere has us reaching for blankets and pillows and curling up with mountains of good reading. So in the spirit of hibernation, this week on Section D, we're looking at design and books. Coming up on the show, we speak to the former mayor of Bogota, Enrique Peñalosa, about how he transformed the Colombian capital by building libraries.
A city reflects a society's values, but a city also creates values. A city speaks through its buildings. It expresses things. And so I also wanted our libraries to be more than just functional.
We head north to Vancouver to be given a guided tour around one of our favorite new libraries by local practice, Bing Tom.
It's an open, flowing space, but I don't think you ever have to go shush, making too much noise. Somehow, I don't think it happens here. It's actually not very noisy.
And we hear from one of the world's greatest living designers, putting the ooh into books. That's Amsterdam-based Irma Baum.
The book is white, so it's a coal trading company, so black. The black coal, a black diamond. We said it's a handbook, it's a tool. If people use the book, it will get dirty. And if you use it a lot, another text will appear on the cover.
All that, plus we visit a beautifully renovated bookstore in Oslo. We drop in on the studio of Slovenia's First Lady of Design, Nika Zupank. And we'll hear about a 1,500-metre super tower that might just pop up in the heart of London. That's all to come on this week's Section D. Do stay tuned. With Kindles selling like hotcakes and mouse clicking replacing the thumb flicking of pages, it's all too grim to consider a possible future where the library is extinct. Thankfully, that time is yet to come. But architects and town planners are having to work harder than ever to ensure new libraries speak to the modern needs of their communities. When the opportunity to design a new library arose unexpectedly on Canada's west coast, its place in contemporary society had to be contemplated at whiplash speed. Our reporter, Lucy Hislop, reports from the unusual and award-winning building that's anything but a book warehouse.
Head and shoulders, knees and toes, eyes, ears.
It's story time for the under fives at City Centre Library in Surrey, British Columbia, a 30-minute drive from Vancouver. Bright red seats are dotted around a circular bookshelf that the kids enter via a small archway. Nearby, a busy cafe commands the centre of this 80,000 square foot building, an expanse of windows, white tilted concrete walls, and snaking staircases that wind up another three stories to an oculus of skylights. But drift from one space to another, from the gaming room and the teenager's lounge, to bubble chairs where you can listen to iPods on full blast, and the noise virtually disappears. Think social hub without the hubbub, says the architect behind it, Bing Tom.
It's an open, flowing space, but I don't think you ever had to go shush, you're making too much noise. Somehow, I don't think it happens here. It's actually not very noisy. There is a lot of activity. I think this is the first library, certainly in our region, where we put a cafe smack in the middle of the library. So the librarian, credit to her, she said, I don't care if people take the coffee up to the third floor, the fourth floor, they bring food into the library, it's okay, because I want this space to be a social center.
Besides, dealing with sound is second nature for Bing, who has a 30-year reputation for designing performing arts centers such as the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. He just needed to work out the future of the library.
I think the secret is to create a variety of spaces. Because libraries traditionally are known as kind of one-off space. You come in and boom, wow, the big space, and then that's it. But in this building, no, it's more like a song. It's more like a serenade. There are movements and there are passages and there are sequences in here that beckons you to kind of explore and come on. So I think libraries are the new cathedrals of our society, because we live in smaller and smaller spaces now, and we need spaces to come into for socialization and to be alone.
We may be in a digital age with scanning machines replacing rubber stamps, but the constant beeping indicates checking out old-fashioned books is still popular. Fuel indeed for Bing's insistence that libraries are relevant in contemporary society.
We can connect virtually, which in itself is a community, but I think the human interaction and the fact that it's a place for knowledge that's more important than ever before, it must perform many more function than just storing of books. So the aspect of human communications, either through peripheral vision or direct interaction, becomes much more important. And so you have to have these variety of spaces that allow for these variety of social interaction.
It was something most needed in Surrey. Vancouver's poorer neighbour is now the fastest growing city in the province and a magnet for immigrants and young families searching for cheaper housing. So when the Canadian government invited authorities to apply for the infrastructure stimulus programme 2 years ago, Surrey jumped at the chance to radically reinvent their old library, starting with his usual drawings before moving on to physical models and computer designs. The 70-year-old admits, however, it was a tall order.
I mean, $30 million in 18 months, 80,000 square feet, it's a very difficult procedure. So Surrey was able to convince the federal government that they had a shovel-ready project in a new central library. The irony, they got the approval for the funding, but they hadn't even hired the architect yet, right? So they hired me at Christmas, and they say, Bing, we have to have this $30 million building, 80,000 square feet, completed in 18 months. I said, oh, you mean completed in design? They say, no, completed in design and construction.
Community engagement via social media sparked new ideas. Hammocks and beanbags for teens, a comfy spot, complete with its own fireplace for the elderly to read newspapers. But Bing always knew his main priority.
Number one, light. Because without proper light, you cannot see. And in a library, it's all about seeing, because you're in a very intense situation of trying to look at the printed page or on the screen. So we designed this building initially as a light lantern. So when you're in the middle of the building, Your four edges to the building is awash with light. But more importantly, we then provided an oculus in the center that brought light down in the center that filtered the light so that the edge lighting on both ends and the lighting in the center were balanced. The best compliment I had was one visitor that came in and said, Bing, I feel oxygenated when I come in.
After completion, he thrives on this type of feedback about his buildings. It seems important to him to make people happy.
Absolutely. Because, you see, in society today, people have enough problems without the architect imposing his ego onto them by saying, look, see how smart I am. So I've always said to the staff in my office, it's most important, number one, to make people feel comfortable. Number two, make the space serene. Number three, when they walk out, they must feel a little taller. That means they have to claim ownership to the building. They have to feel that this is my building, this is a building of my community, and it's a building about me.
In Surrey, British Columbia, for Monocle, this is Lucy Hislop.
It's time for a very short break, but stay tuned to hear how one mayor changed the face and fortunes of his South American city with the help of a few mega libraries.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. When Enrique Peñalosa held the office of Bogota's mayor a decade ago, he set to work immediately with a carefully planned program of transforming the city and the impoverished lives of the majority of its inhabitants. One of his greatest legacies was the construction of 4 mega libraries and 12 smaller ones across the capital. I spoke to Mr. Peñalosa on the line from New York to hear more about his literary legacy.
Since I had lived in the United States, I was always very impressed by the great library system I found there. In small communities, they had always a library where one could find anything, and whatever they didn't have, they would find for you in a matter of a few days. They would buy it or ask for another library for it. And in Bogota, there were no libraries. I remember always that downtown, there was only one big library, which was financed by the central bank. And there were huge lines of mostly students who had homework or things like this, who for maybe sometimes one or more even than a block line or even 2 blocks waiting to get in. So for me, it was a priority. When I became mayor, I had this idea to do libraries. Then there was also a question of how to do them. And I also had the idea that a city reflects a society's values, but a city also creates values. A city speaks through its buildings. It expresses things. And so I also wanted our libraries to be more than just functional, as we did also with our schools in the poorest neighborhoods. We wanted to do beautiful buildings, and somewhat even majestic, or a little bit like temples, because we wanted also to send a message. The way churches, for example, in the medieval Europe, you can see from miles away what was important to that society. It was clear religion. These churches were built because they expressed the religiosity, the Christianity of a society, but also they created, they promoted this kind of religious and Christian feeling. In this way, for example, maybe you would have been more efficient instead of doing... let me first go back to what we did. We did, finally, in a short term as mayor, we did 3 large libraries and 12 smaller ones. And later on, I had left the land for another library, and I asked a big business family, Colombian family, the Santo Domingos, if they could be generous to make a donation for the 4th one, which we could not finish, and they were very generous, and they paid for the 4th large library, which also had a theater.
You commissioned some of the most important architects in Colombia to build these libraries, and they really are sort of cathedrals of culture, and in some of the poorest neighbourhoods of Bogota. And obviously they've been an enormous success. Do you say that they have single-handedly sort of breathed life into areas where there really before was no quality of life?
Exactly. We wanted to change the values. We wanted people to realise, to learn that education, that knowledge was important. It's in a certain way, this is a way to combat corruption and the problems with the drug dealers and corruption, because if we have a library building that is more beautiful than the shopping mall, because in the shopping mall the poor person goes in and they feel intimidated. They feel they have to buy something and they don't have money. But instead, in these beautiful library buildings, we get many young children who live in a very, very humble home. Sometimes even the whole family in a room. They don't even know their father. They, of course, don't have any magazines or books at home. And so from this very dire poverty, they enter this beautiful building. And so I would say the meaning of being Colombia begins to acquire some sense. I mean, being Colombian begins to acquire some meaning, because it's not just the fact that you can be within a territory, but that the fact that you are able to access this beautiful place, not because you have money, not because you have a PhD from Harvard, simply because you have a Colombian ID inside your pocket. And these buildings begin to create a different kind of hero. I mean, we could have many TV advertisements saying that education or learning is important, but people learn more through example, through the deeds than through the words. And so clearly, I would like that the young person who is the hero in his neighborhood is not the one that arrives in a fancy motorcycle and has gold chains and expensive clothes because maybe he's involved in drug activities, but rather the hero is one that goes in an old bicycle and does sports and does music and goes to the library and reads. So I would say the building is important, very important to those who go to this building and they feel well. They feel well received, they feel well treated, but also even for those who don't go, who just see this iconic building in the neighborhood and they begin to see that learning is something to be valued. It's not just the things that to be valued, it's not just expensive cars or expensive clothes, but culture and knowledge.
So they become sort of the beating hearts of the poorer areas of the cities, that people come together as communities and sort of people don't just get cooped up in their homes playing computer games or dealing drugs.
And also we were able to connect. These libraries are located, all of them, in a park, in a large area. So there's green area around it, which maybe is not very abundant in Bogota. And they are linked by bicycle ways and by pedestrian networks so that all of them can be reached by protected bicycle ways. This has not, the parking in these libraries has not worked as well as I would have hoped. It has not been well organized, but at least tens of thousands of people ride the bicycles by it. So it's almost like a different society is emerging because the protected bicycle way also is a symbol that it raises the social status of the cyclist. It shows that a citizen on a $30 bicycle is equally important to one on a $30,000 car. So it's like a new kind of society. It emerges where the library is the central focus point, where many people walk, ride bicycles. I think we are trying to raise the dignity of the human being. Because in developing countries, most of the money is always spent is in roads. Roads for the upper income citizens' cars. So now what we try to do is to build things for the human being.
Restoring democracy to the city.
Exactly, it's democracy. That's exactly as I like that way of looking at it. Because it really is, we are seeing the human being is the important thing. We spend less money in roads and less space for cars. And we spend more money in schools, in pedestrian spaces, in parks, in libraries. And clearly there is a conflict because we don't have the money to do both. So what do we do first? So some of these libraries, which are very luxurious, and these fantastic schools are very luxurious, and even some pedestrian streets, which are high quality, are located in neighborhoods where the roads don't have pavement. And we are talking about a city, despite the fact that it's a very big and modern city, where more than 20% of streets don't have pavement. We have more than 1 million citizens who do not have paved streets in front of their homes. So the normal thing would have been to invest first in the paving of roads. So instead we did no. We are going to do sidewalks or pavements, as you call them in England, I understand. Do pavements and pedestrian streets and bikeways and great schools and nurseries. And sometimes even community centers with even a swimming pool, and then these big libraries, which are of course we don't have we only have four of these, but they become icons. In many developing countries, the big iconic building is the airport, the international airport, where the international executives come and go and all this. And this is wonderful. This is fine, but I think it's more useful to create a more democratic society, these iconic buildings which provide identity and also transmit values, again, because we are creating different values when we do a building like this, which is a library, which is, again, it's not just a library. It's a place where almost a young person can find some refuge from poverty, maybe it's from violence at home, and they can go there and listen to music or read a book or read a magazine or even just do nothing, just to be in a beautiful building surrounded by peace and by respect for human dignity.
That was Enrique Peñalosa, master of the Mega Library and former mayor of Bogotá. And in honor of his work, we've chosen our favorite Colombian music track. This is La Tierra del Olvido, which means Land of Forgetfulness, sung by a selection of Colombia's musical stars.
Como la luna que alumbra por la noche los caminos, como las hojas al viento, como el sol espanta el frío, como la tierra la lluvia, como el mar espera el río, así espero tu regreso a la tierra del olvido.
That was La Tierra del Olvido by a medley of Colombian pop greats. You're listening to Section D. Stay tuned. We're off to Amsterdam next. Welcome back. Exquisite, beautiful design is one of the greatest weapons in a book's armory against the advance of the digital revolution. Irma Baum is an internationally acclaimed book designer living in Amsterdam, and she's responsible for some of the most beautiful books published in recent times. Baum works directly with a wide range of commissioners to create individual masterpieces in their look, feel, smell and design. We sent reporter Louise Stoddard to meet her at her studio in Amsterdam.
For me, it's not just turning the pages. It's more than turning the pages. It's the edges, it's the way the book falls open, it's the smell, it's the tactility. And working now as a book designer is extremely interesting because of the internet and iPad.
I can see we've got the Think book here, which is your five-year project, which is absolutely huge and a beautiful book. Perhaps you can talk us through it.
It's a book in collaboration with Jan Pijnappel, an art historian, and me, and our commissioner, Mr. Paul Ventenaar van Vlissingen of SHV Holdings. It's a multinational based in the Netherlands. It used to be a coal trading company. And he said, can my company exist, our family-owned company exist in 1996, 100 years, and I want to have something unusual. Can you do this? That was in 1991, he asked. So carte blanche, we could do whatever we liked. And so the only thing he told us, make something unusual. The book was clear it will never be for sale. So it's for shareholders. And you can only be born as a shareholder. And every time when a shareholder becomes 18, he or she will get a book.
How do you start designing a book like this?
If you do a book like this, then it's not about designing a book. It's more the idea, the vision. So the book ends in 1799 and starts in 1996. So it goes back in time. But we don't have any chapters. We don't have page numbers. And so with these specific events, you can tell a story about the company. And the book has no articulation in text, so all the text is basically sort of body text. So you have to read and spend time with the book to understand it. And to help you a bit, we have to introduce case studies. We have questions like, what do you learn from mistakes? Why did you get up this morning? Why do you shake hands? Questions like that, so that you get curious. 2,136 pages.
So much detail.
It's a lot of detail. Also, the book is white. So it's a coal trading company, so black. The black coal, the black diamond. We said it's a handbook, it's a tool. If people use the book, it will get dirty. And if you use it a lot, another text will appear on the cover. And we also said to our commissioner, Paul, said it's also nice, so you can also check if people actually read the book or use the book.
And has any text appeared yet?
I'm not sure, because a lot of people are so afraid that the book gets dirty, so they put a wrap around it, which is really not what they should do. But well, anyway.
So this has been the biggest one, obviously, that you've done.
Yeah, and I think this will be the only one. Has paper, which is my own recipe. I only in a paper maker know it. It has, if you put it in specific light, things appear. The book has a stainless steel spine, so it lays open very beautifully. On the fore edge, there's a tulip field, but if the book is closed, there's a poem. It has a wonderful watermark in it with the corporate philosophy of the company, because a corporate philosophy, you should not print. It's something you should feel.
It's, I can continue. An amazing project. It's amazing. What I'd really like, because we've still got some other books sat here on the table, and moving on from ThinkBook, even though I could spend a whole day looking through this and talking to you about it. Obviously, you have moved on and created so much more after ThinkBook. We've got the Sheila Hicks book in front of us now. Can you describe what that looks like and what it is?
When I was called by a person who asked me if I would do a book for Sheila Hicks, I had no clue who Sheila Hicks was. Why should I know? It's a textile artist, but a very strong, very interesting lady. And she said, "Do you want to make a book with me?" So, well, let's check it out. I don't know. Because for me, spending time or making a book is spending time on a subject. Like the SHV book, 5 years later, it's 5 years later. I didn't get children because of making the book.
So it's really, it's a personal investment for you.
Oh, yes, it is. It is, of course. Yeah, and if I do something, I cannot do it half. It's very well photographed. It's very well printed. It's very well bound, this book. And basically what I did was putting on the right page 100 of her miniatures. And I always ask Sheila, can you write a text for it? Can you describe it? I got this idea to give the book on the top left and bottom side a sort of specific edge. And it looks almost like a weaving. And every book is unique, like all her textiles are unique. And then we had the problem, if you have a book with all these colorful weavings and this wonderful edge, what do you put on the cover? I didn't want to put anything on the cover. I thought the book as the object. That it should look like this container of thought and images. And the moment you open it, suddenly it reveals. Then you see the beauty. Yeah, it should be white. I had enormous discussion with the commissioner in New York. I had to put a textile piece on it. So I'm not doing a textile piece on it. So I put a box next to this table and put all the stuff I was working on in a box. And I thought, I'll stop. I could not imagine having a book for Sheila Hicks with a piece of her textile on it. And I didn't want to compromise on that. And then at some point you have to make a decision. So, and Sheila, of course, was with me. And in the end, the commission in New York said, well, let's do it. let's do the book you want to do. And so, well, and then for me, it was a compromise to have this. But the Sheila Hicks book is also a very beautiful book, I think.
I read somewhere that you aren't a big fan of homemade books and handicraft books, that you're not.
No.
Can you explain why that is?
I think that the book should be an industrial made book, because then it's the idea of spreading information and it's accessible to a larger audience. The handmade book implicates also that it becomes more an art piece. So sometimes artists, mostly female artists, come to me and have this handmade book. I could really, the creep, so how do you get, I don't like it at all. And then they think, oh, can you make something more professional out of it? I said, no, you have already done it, go to somebody else. I cannot get over it then. All the hours of the day I'm working on books and making books. My intention and ambition is really to make a book as a tool, that a book works for somebody and it gets into the world.
Well, look forward to seeing more from you.
That was our reporter Louise Stoddard with Irma Baum in her Amsterdam studio. And from book designer to bookshop, it's time to head north to Oslo, where Norwegian architects Jarmund Vigsnes walked our reporter Andreas Lindvåg through their recent radical renovation of Oslo's oldest bookstore, Tanum Karl Johan.
The challenge now was to create a bookstore for the future, as it was called in the brief. And what is meant with that is that it should be a bookstore that both worked with the traditional specialized departments of this bookstore, but also was very flexible in the more general parts of the store. And it should also reflect the future of the book as maybe a more physical item in competition with digital books and reading boards, etc. And in that way, the interior of the store should be, in a way, have a physical presence that built upon the issue of the book as a physical piece.
And how is this reflected in the design?
In terms of organization of the store, the backside of the store is maybe more like a library with a dark background. Both a high back wall, which is filled with books, and also the ceiling has a dark background, which brings the book quite forth in presence for the viewer. While the center part of the store is much more flexible, based upon movable units, which can change all the time, so it's a kind of interior of flexibility mainly. We've used the logo colors of the bookstore, which was very dark green and very light green in the combination, where with the flexible part is it's much more of the lighter green, while the specialized the more static parts of the store is the dark green. And we've balanced this against quite extensive use of quite rough veneer or pine, which sort of reflects the thoughts of the mobile parts of the store as packaging cages, in a way. This milieu is then put upon a very light floor that reflects both the light of the store, but also makes the physical presence of the users of the store quite clear. We had to work quite a lot with the employees to convince them that it was right to open it up towards the street and to avoid the traditional window exhibition as such. This is also being doubled up with a faceted mirror wall, which reflects both the interior but also the connection to the outdoors throughout the store. And this is maybe like a French brasserie or something. It's to double up the life of the stores, the users, the dynamics of using the store. We think that's very important. I think that's present urbanism in a way, that you pass by a window, whether it's a shop or a restaurant. What attracts you is maybe not an exhibition of what's going on there, but it's to see people themselves using the place. You walk into a restaurant when it's almost crowded. You don't walk into an empty restaurant, and it's the same thing with a bookstore, basically. And we use the glowing light, the color, the warmth color of the veneer and the colors to create maybe a bit cozy, traditional feeling of a milieu for books. At the same time, we balance this against use of a very light floor, extensive use of faceted mirrors on the wall to create a sort of brightness and freshness, which balanced against the more mellow tones of the store. This is both to create an attractive visual milieu, but it was also a focus upon keeping the old clients, so to speak. I mean, the middle-aged typical clients, users of the bookstore, but also bring in some attractions for a new public, a younger public, in a way.
That was Andreas Lindvåg with Jarmund Vigsnes at Tanum Karl Johan, Oslo's oldest bookshop. Time for a quick break before we head to lovely Ljubljana.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
Welcome back to Section D. Ljubljana might not spring to mind as an obvious destination for a budding designer to set up her studio, but the brilliant young Slovenian, Nika Zupank, isn't just proving it's possible to operate as an international designer from her home capital. She's also spearheading a new generation of local creatives, too. Monocle's Amy Gutman visited her to hear more.
It's a mild winter's night in the heart of Ljubljana's old town where I meet Nika Zupank at the site of her newest creation and first ever interior, an Italian wine bar attached to one of the city's most popular restaurants.
I was so happy and interested to become part of Ljubljana, so I was challenged by the fact to do something in my hometown. And on the other hand, I really love to eat. I'm in love with food. It was also a very passionate 6 months.
We begin wading through hundreds of Ljubljana's great and good who have turned out to see and be seen, and also for a glimpse of Nika's signature style, modern, balanced with a light dose of femininity. Our tour starts at the front door, where one of Nika's most recognizable designs hangs as a welcome sign. Giant red and black lamps, the shape of cherries.
I think the main idea was to use the cherries, but of course this is a restaurant which is built around this very big 300-year-old tea in the Ljubljana, and of course the idea was to underline this feeling of a garden. So the cherries seemed like a perfect match.
It works. The tree growing through the center of the bar creates a sheltered garden. The bass is thumping, and whether it's the decor, the booze, the free food, or the monstrous spit roast outside, everyone seems to think it's a success. We escape to a quiet back room to continue the interview.
You have such a seductive style. Where does that come from?
The DNA of my design is actually a storytelling. You could see it in many ways, from being seductive, from being also, for myself, very minimal, very clean, sometimes a little bit difficult to read.
Nika's work is described as techno-chic, femme fatale, and provocative. It's easy to see all those things in objects like an electric hot plate resembling a compact mirror, or a slender, shiny-handled black feather duster, which elevates the household chore to a glamorous pastime. Or there's the divan, masculine, minimalist, and mod, bar the black satin bow tied at the back. A Lolita lamp has a bell-shaped shade with a frilly edge. Even if these things sound frivolous, they're not. Nika won't let them be.
I tend to be very critical to my own ideas. I think that we actually really live in an overconsumption society. And being a designer, it's quite a challenging and also a responsible job, because sometimes the question, if we really need another chair, it is a question. But then again, if you are bringing new pieces, new objects, which question our society or question small things that we are surrounded in our everyday routine, then I think the design has its role to also change our perception.
I mention her prototype maid chair, an object as sexy as it sounds, with curvy contours.
This path of objects or designs which are produced in limited edition, it's very interesting. Because it's there, you don't really need to buy them, to have them, but they're in the magazines, they're in the books. So they're, in a way, influencing what we think.
She asks serious questions with her current collection, appropriately titled Self-Discipline. It includes highly functional forms. Accordion folders create filing spaces, and wheels parallel a modern culture constantly demanding flexibility. The wardrobe expands and contracts like a concertina, again, mimicking the vacillating rhythms of consumption.
A lot of your objects, especially your accordion objects, they just scream, totally practical, yet great design quality. You don't sacrifice style over substance or vice versa. How do you overcome that challenge?
This is actually the challenge. This is why I love my job. This is what I'm actually inspired by, to find the balance, to do an object which is actually elegant. I think an elegant, it's a very important word because it's speaking about something which is timeless, so it's not defined by style or by certain age.
And these pieces really do feel like they're about discipline, they're about organizing your life. What came first? Did you take any inspiration from the climate, or had you been working on this before?
I'm sometimes joking that I'm in a way connected with the feeling all around me, and each year I try to choose a title which on the one hand explains the collection, but on the other hand, as you said, also reflects the climate in the society.
One creation which defies her current view is a Perspex cradle, one of her first designs, meant to explore emotional ergonomics, and something she designed when frustrated by the overly conservative baby furniture on the market.
I wanted to do an object which has no function at all, but we react on it when we see it. And at that point I was very ambitious, and I thought that this was a perfect piece for Cartel. Cartel is an Italian company working a lot with Philip Stark, and nothing happened, but I gained a lot of attention. But this story got a very nice ending this year, because I was actually contacted by Philip Stark, who was looking for a cradle. he got a baby, and actually out of all the cradles in the world, he chose that cradle, which was produced just in 2006. They find it, his team find it on the internet. It was really a nice compliment and really, really nice metaphysical circle.
So the cradle will be used, even though it wasn't meant to be functional.
Yeah.
And for Philip Stark's baby, no less. Do you feel as though, we say in America, now you have arrived? Was that sort of your I've arrived moment?
Yeah, it was one of I have arrived moments for sure.
Despite having arrived in all the top design cities of Europe, Nika insists on living where she always has, in Ljubljana, where she finds the greatest inspiration.
Being a designer in Slovenia is actually very good because it's a drive away from Milan. And it's like a half an hour from some of the top-end companies that I work with or I want to work with. So in sense of really, really practical product design reality, is that being in Slovenia is actually a great spot. I love big cities, but I love them for a certain period. Then I need my own peace, and I think I'm most creative when I'm kind of pulled back. And I also need a lot of nature. I'm always saying that a part of my studio is going up and down a hill which is nearby Ljubljana, and I'm always joking that I cannot move because I cannot take the hill with me.
And for now, she doesn't have to.
That was our reporter Amy Gutman with Nika Zupank in Ljubljana. Time for another tiny break before we scale the heights of a possible super tower in central London. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Section D. With London hosting the Olympics this year, thoughts have turned to absorbing thousands of guests for a short time. But London, like every city, is facing a puzzle about how to house the growing number of longer-term residents who want to live there. Rather than add to the urban sprawl, one company has designed a 1,500-metre-high super tower, complete with high-speed vertical trains and parklands on the upper floors. This is right next to St Paul's Cathedral. Is it just a flight of fancy, though? Or is this the future? We send our reporter, Amanda Brown, to scale the issue.
The 1979 single High Rise by Trainspotter draws a pretty grim picture of tower living in London. But in 2012, London faces a housing shortage and a population growth as big as 100,000 people per year. In response to the big question of where we're going to house everyone, architects Thomas and James Tatum came up with a mile-high tower designed to become a village in the sky, smack bang in the middle of London.
This has been talked of before, but we actually took the scale of parks, we took the scale of small villages almost, where people could kind of go and shop, and took that scale and replicated it within the town. So you had huge public spaces in the sky. Those were all connected together by, actually there was a kind of a public walkway that spiraled on the exterior of the building and connected all these very large public volumes together. The possibility of the city is always its spontaneity, always the kind of the space where two things meet. What we wanted to do is look at taking that and organising it in a tall structure.
Towers have had bad press in the past. Pop music, literature and popular culture have associated tower living with dystopia, the most famous example being the novel High Rise by J.G. Ballard, which inspired the 80s Doctor Who episodes Paradise Towers.
Well, now that we've been introduced, I think some explanations are in order. I mean, we're visitors to Paradise Towers, only just arrived, and you can't really expect Mel to understand what you're talking about.
No visitors.
Pardon?
No visitors, no ball games, no fly posts, no visitors.
You mean visitors aren't allowed?
No visitors ever. Not since time start.
Thomas Tatum is aware of the negative perception and believes the answer is to develop a tower with all the amenities and opportunities for mingling that can currently be had in the city.
You know, if we look at something like Trellick Tower, the perception of that building as an object has gone from being something that was a symbol of optimism to being a building which has been hated because it is symbolised with social failure, to now being a building that's seen almost nostalgically and reminding us of a period in which there was a kind of optimism about tall buildings. It's also full of architects, but interestingly, that building in its physical state has never changed, but our perception of it has changed. So our view is that it's not necessarily the object that creates the social failure. There's obviously lots of other layers of things that inform the way that a building's in use, you know, the way a building's used. For us, the way we tried to resolve that or start to answer those questions was to try and make all the spaces that surrounded and interacted with the housing being spaces that were really that an extrusion of the city. So spaces which are the everyday things we need, as well as spaces which are about enjoyment, spaces which are about meeting. That's the fundamental opportunity of the urban experience.
Michael Lowndes, Executive Director of Urban Planning and Design Consultancy, Turley Associates, thinks Tatum's Tower is overambitious.
It is actually a very bold enterprise, and it would actually take up quite a lot of space at ground level. And the problem with taking up space at ground level is that that would require significant clearance of existing buildings, and it's unlikely that any developer would be able to assemble a site in the very bitty ownership pattern of central London. It goes in central London because it has to rely upon transport and other infrastructure support. But in putting it in the middle of London, one has all sorts of problems. There's a problem with construction. It is almost inconceivable logistically. Plugging it into services, our antiquated Victorian electricity system simply couldn't cope. They're not even thinking about sewage and water supplies and all that sort of stuff. And then can you imagine the poor person that lives next door to this tower who would be in permanent shade? The tower would act as a huge global sundial, and large parts of the city would actually be overshadowed at various parts of the day. And then the nature of the building would actually generate all sorts of microclimatic impacts. It would create wind, and it would create really uncomfortable conditions at ground level.
A tower of this magnitude not only challenges people's perceptions, but also our short-term approach to planning and development.
Is the technology there to build a structure of this size? Yes. Is there the vision? Very few people will actually consider housing in the context of a 100-year time frame. Very few people are willing to actually look at it in the context of a 5-year time frame. When people kind of object against tall buildings, there's a kind of fear in the objection. The buildings that they seek to protect obviously have a lot of value and have a lot of meaning and contain a lot of history, which is important to almost the kind of psyche of the English. And in other cultures, buildings, you could say, hold less value in terms of history and tradition. But we're not looking to change the kind of values that buildings such as St. Paul's have. But we also have to examine the moment that those buildings are produced is also a moment where people have fear. And if we start to consider how we're going to look to alter a city like London in a much longer time frame, the idea of a tall structure becomes less frightening, becomes less fearful.
The tower is not being built, but the suggestion of it has kicked off a timely debate about London's skyline and the way Londoners will live in the future.
That was our reporter Amanda Brown talking tower living in London. And from the dizzying heights of our imagination, back to Earth with a bump. That brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Fear not, we'll be back next week with a feast for the ears as we tuck into the tasty world of design and food. This week's show was produced by Gillian DeBias. Our researchers were Taya Erdl and Hazel Pfeiffer, and our editor was Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening.